The call starts right now, and that is we have here Rick Clemons. And Rick Clemons is the founder of the IECP, which is an organization that helps children, and specifically children with autism and disabilities, to be able to be included in school and also other areas in the community. Rick has been involved in this for quite a while. He's worked in various settings, including schools, after school and summer programs, homes, work programs and socialization programs that support individuals with disabilities. Throughout his career, he has been committed and active in the integration, inclusion, and socialization of individuals he has worked with. He has worked different sides of this, actually. He was a teacher for a while. He was also has developed a close relationship with hospitals as well to pioneer with including children with autism in state hospital and general education classrooms. And Rick has a very sought-after speaker as well, and he's going to come help us today discuss all the things related to inclusion in school and areas in the community. And we know that a lot of you have asked us a lot of questions so far, so without further ado, I'd like to say, Rick, thanks so much for helping us out today. A lot of people are going to be listening today, and we sort of, if you can kind of take the floor and tell us a little about what IECP is about, so people kind of get a little more background on it than what I've read.
Okay, great. Well, thanks for having me. For any time here, this is, I've got to admit to everyone, this is my first teleconference. I've been doing public speaking since 1992 and provide conferences all over the country. This will be my first teleconference, which is odd not seeing faces that I'm talking to. So if at any point, feel free, especially Ernest, to have me repeat something, or if it's not clear, just let me know. I am, as Ernest said, my name is Rick Clemons. I'm the Director of Inclusive Education and Community Partnership. We're an agency primarily based in California supporting children with autism in inclusive settings. neat thing about the agency is that we will only work with kids in inclusive natural environments, which has been because that's what our philosophy is. We believe that's where children belong, and so they're typically developing friends in natural environments. And our service delivery model is specifically geared towards supporting kids in more natural environments. The neat thing about that is that we've become extremely large, which demonstrates the number of kids being included, which is the best, and then, of course, the need for support for those kids when they are included. A little bit of background about myself. I've been working in the field since 1985. In 1991, I was the first teacher in Ventura County, which is a fairly large geographical county in California, to include a child with autism into a general education classroom. Didn't know what I was doing at the time, and when we look back at the old videotapes, it wasn't an ideal program by any means. But regardless of that, the child we were working with made significant progress, He went from my special day classroom, he was in fifth grade, where he had been in special day classrooms since preschool, into a general education program full day, and just, as I said, made tremendous progress and did great. From there, we started to get phone calls to do more and more consulting. And we currently now will probably work with thousands of kids with autism in schools. About, 6 or 7 years ago, we started working with regional centers in inclusive programs. And the way that worked is I'm an educator, and I had no interest in expanding the agency by any means. We were plenty busy in the schools. But there was a lot of social skills programs happening with kids with autism that were all segregated, specialized segregated programs, mainly clinic-based. And I went to Regional Center because I had been working with them for years through the school systems on their part of advocating for kids to be included and coming to me to talk more about that and doing trainings for them. So I had relationships with the Regional Center staff. And I said to them, you guys are doing all of these segregated type social skills programs, and I have two issues with that. One is your mission statement is to be more inclusive and provide inclusion opportunities for kids with autism and other disabilities. But also we know that kids with autism specifically have a real difficult time generalizing from one setting to the other, especially a setting which is completely artificial to a setting which is completely natural, and with that a whole host of other challenges and difficulties. And they had said to me at the time, well, we agree with you. The issue is that parents are wanting social skills, and those programs are all that's out there, so why don't you write us a proposal? At the time, I had said, there's no way. I'm swamped, and they encouraged me to, and I wrote a real lofty proposal a kind of best practice proposal working on social skills and play dates, which was one child with autism and a typically developing peer from the neighborhood, community, church, temple, school, et cetera, and having a real play date, just as you would if you didn't have a disability, and facilitating play and the social skills within that environment. Curtis, did you have something there?
Yes, I'm still here.
Oh, okay, I thought I heard something. I'm sorry. So anyhow, so we took that program, which was really one-on-one, one child with autism, one typically developing peer, and then a what we call a play facilitator, but a professional facilitating that play and working on social skills within that, figuring that would be the best, most ideal program. Everybody said that Regional Center would never agree to that based on the intensity of the program and the individualness and the one-on-one nature of it as far as just one kid at a time. Of course, the natural environment part they would like. Well, they loved it, and within a month we have we had 30 kids. Now we're up to an agency of about 300 with staff, with about 1,000 kids that we're serving a year through different regional centers and school districts. So it's been quite a wild ride that way. But again, really speaks to the importance of inclusion. And that's where we are now. So currently we work with regional centers throughout California, and we work in school programs throughout California primarily, although I do consulting outside of California as well, on including kids with autism into regular education settings. Our regional center programs have grown from just socially based to now we really have three basic program models. They're all inclusive or natural environments. One of them is the social play program I mentioned earlier. The other program is a community inclusion program, which where we basically say if you have a child with disability, such as autism, that that child has the right under the Americans with Disabilities Act in the United States to participate in any community program which is available to children without disabilities. But the reality is, even though the law states that, there needs to be support to help that child and help that staff be successful. So we'll go into Boy Scouts, Girl Scouts, YMCA, karate, dance, organized sports, any type of community activity that a parent would want their child to participate in, and we help facilitate their inclusion into that program. And then the third program we're involved in is a behavioral program where we're really looking at the inclusive family. And we say to a family, what are the issues that, what are the behavior challenges that are interfering with your ability as a family to have a more inclusive life and to participate in the activities which you would otherwise be participating in if your child did not have a disability? It might be something such as being able to go to a restaurant or being able to have a time that we all sit down together and read a book, or going to parties, or going camping, or we had a kid that was going sailing, and working with the family on conquering and addressing those behavioral challenges so that the family and the child can participate in more inclusive type of activities that are important to the family. Again, using behavioral strategies rooted in ABA, applied behavioral analysis. So that's the scope of our regional center programs, our school programs. Do we want to start with a couple of questions? Do you want me to give a little overview of what inclusion is? Where do you guys want to
go with
that?
That's a good idea. And also, too, some people might not be familiar with the term regional center, if you could explain that to people.
Yeah, thank you. Regional center is a California program. It's funded through the Department of Developmental Services. Many of you, at least I know, I saw that there were some questions from out of the country, and I really can't speak to that as well. But within the U.S., most states have a Department of Developmental Services or a Department of Developmental Disability Services, and that's the department that supports kids outside of at the educational system. In California, we have regional centers, which is part of a law called the Lanterman Act. And what the regional centers do is they're under the umbrella of the Department of Developmental Services. And they provide services, basically. They provide a whole range of services to individuals with disabilities other than educational services. So from birth until death, Regional Center is involved in children, in individuals with disabilities' lives, providing everything from early infant care to parent respite to work to supported living and supported work, everything, like I said, but school-related services.
Okay. Very good. And then you were going to explain the other term, which I just forgot.
Let me talk a little bit about what inclusion is, just so we make sure everyone's
right.
on the same page
that's
with this. Is that what you were thinking, Ernest?
Yeah, that's what it was.
Many of you are familiar with the term inclusion. Some of you may be more familiar with the term mainstreaming. We used to say the old term in the 70s and 80s was that we were going to mainstream individuals with autism or individuals with other disabilities. And what mainstreaming meant was the child would kind of go into these environments and then come out of these environments. In a school setting, mainstreaming meant the child's primary home was a general education class, was a special education classroom, and they might be mainstreamed into a regular education classroom for math or for art or for PE or for recess. Inclusion means that's the child's home base. Inclusion means the child's included, they're part of. They belong, they have a home in dental ed or in the natural environment community. So when we talk about inclusion, what we're talking about is having individuals with autism be in that environment, not be guests in that environment, but be true members of that environment, be it a classroom where they would start their day in that classroom, end their day in that classroom, and the teacher or the students would view them as a member of that classroom because they would be, to a church or a temple where that person becomes part of that church or temple, or a Boy Scouts troop where they become part. They don't just come on special days when we feel we can be conducive, but the child actually becomes part of that Boy Scout troop. They become part of that dance group. Obviously, to make that successful, we need to provide support to help that individual and to help the adults who are with that child, you know, whenever they're there, to be able to best include them. We used to work off of a model, and unfortunately, it's come back a little bit, and some people are still using this model, which we call the readiness model. And what that meant was that the child could be included or mainstreamed or integrated when they were ready. And what we know about many of our kids with autism and other disabilities is they're never truly, quote-unquote, ready, meaning that they've acquired all the skills necessary to be in the Boy Scouts without any extra supports or to be in a regular education classroom without any extra supports. So when we talk about a child ready, what we say from an inclusion point of view is there's no such thing as ready. The question is the environment ready? And if not, then the environment needs to do what it needs to do ASAP to become ready for that child. The child has a right to be there. It's in the child's best interest to be there. We want children to have rich, quality experiences in their life and to be part of life with people without disabilities. And so it does not matter what the degree of their disability is. They have the right to be there, and they should be there in almost all cases. And then it's our job as the adults in the child's world to provide the supports to help them be successful. That's probably the most simple definition of what inclusion is. I would say I have a basic premise that I work out of under, and that is that it is imperative that children with a diagnosis of autism spectrum disorder have quality experiences in inclusive environments and positive interactions with neurotypical children of a similar age. So if we are saying they should be in those environments 100% of the time or just part of the time, the bottom line is that kids with autism need to have quality experiences with individuals without autism. It's an imperative part of their quality of life as well as their behavioral treatment. That's basically what we're working under. The other thing to understand about inclusion is that there is really no cookie-cutter approach to including children with ASD or autism spectrum disorder. There are conceptual understandings and there's principles that should be applied, but there's not a cookie-cutter approach. So it's not easy to say, Johnny has autism, I'm going to put Johnny in a third-grade classroom, and this is what that's going to look like. There's some basic principles we work under, but each child's program needs to be based individually because every child is different and every environment is different. So it makes it a very difficult program. It's definitely doable. By no means is it not doable. It is definitely doable. We've seen thousands of kids be extremely successful in ways that nobody ever thought they would be successful. But it is challenging, and the key is that the children do need the support, and the adults working with the children need the support. The other basic premise I would work under that I would comment for people is that an understanding, I'd call this more of a prerequisite understanding, that if you're going to include a child with autism, you need to have this prerequisite understanding, and that is that children with autism spectrum disorder can learn incidentally, and they will model from their peers given the right learning environment and interventions. When this occurs, a world of learning becomes available to the child. So if one believes that a child with autism can only learn when being directly taught to, then inclusion wouldn't be the most appropriate environment. But I would argue very strongly that most kids with autism, I've never met a child with autism that put into an environment which is comfortable, anxiety reduced, thought out, we put the interventions into place, that they will be able to learn incidentally or learn from modeling of their peers. There's a study that was done in the early 70s, early 70s, late 60s. It was one of those instrumental studies in understanding autism. And what they did was they took kids without the autism into a clinic, and they brought them into a room, and one at a time, of course, and then the child would go into a room they'd never been to before, and in the room was an adult. And as soon as the child walked in, the adult would start bouncing the ball, and on the other side of the room would be another ball, and the adult wouldn't say anything to the child. And typically developing fear would look at the adult, walk over to the ball, and start bouncing the ball. And the adult would then bounce the ball off the wall, and the typically developing child would then bounce the ball off the wall. So it was concluded that children without autism can learn incidentally or can learn from modeling. Then they brought mm-hmm. children with autism into the room, one at a time, of course, to a room they had never been in before, a place they had never been to before, an adult they had never seen before, not knowing what was going to happen, no priming, no transitional prompts, and the adult would start bouncing the ball, and the child with autism would withdraw, would escape, would turn to the corner and engage in self-stimulatory behaviors. Mm-hmm. And what was concluded by that in the late 60s, early 70s, was that children with autism could not learn incidentally. Now, that was obviously 30 or so years ago, and what we've learned since then is that study did not tell us that kids with autism can't learn incidentally. What that study told us was what we know today, which is that kids with autism, when put into a novel situation without familiarity, will have extreme increases in anxiety and will seek to attune out as a way of avoiding or minimizing that anxiety and that discomfort that's being caused. And what we've seen is if we were to prime the child, bring them to an environment they've been in before, a familiar person, and we had a picture schedule or a social story of what was going to happen ahead of time, so we lowered the anxiety, felt some familiarity, the child would have done much better. And we see that in natural environments all the time. When the kids are familiar to the child, when the kids have been taught how to interact with the child with autism, when they know what the schedule is going to be for the day and what the activities are going to be for the day, the children are in a much better place to be able to model from their peers because their anxiety is lower. And that's a big area of autism that we're really looking at now. We're kind of late on this, but we've been knowing for years, and there's some research currently being done at UCLA on this, that the rates that autism, in many ways, some of the behaviors that we see are anxiety behaviors. That the child with autism has a difficult time processing the world around them is much more prone to having issues with high anxiety, which make it difficult for the child to function naturally. Effectively within the community and the environments in which they are. And the last thing I'll say on that note as far as inclusion for kids with autism is a recognition that inclusion can occur everywhere. Inclusion can occur at school across the grade levels. Inclusion can occur at play dates, at community activities such as camps, sports, scouts, community associations such as church or temple, community events such as concerts and carnivals, family functions, work, really everywhere. The idea of inclusion is that just because a child has a diagnosis does not mean that they're not able to participate in the same aspects of life as those people who don't have a disability. And again, it becomes our job as the adults to help that child to be successful. I think I said this earlier, but there's a quote from Judy Montgomery from the early 90s which states, "Inclusion means you belong with your age-appropriate peers, and the adults in your world will provide the support you need to stay and learn with your friends." And I think that really...
Wow. Yeah. Say that one more time.
The quote again from Jeanne Montgomery is that inclusion means you belong with your age-appropriate peers and the adults in your world will provide the support you need to stay and learn with your friends. Again, meaning that it's our responsibility to make this a reality for kids. We're the adults. We're responsible for the child's well-being. And we need to make sure that they are able to have those opportunities in life, which they would otherwise not have if we were not providing the support to and the impetus to make sure kids are included.
Right.
Super. I'll share with you one more quote, actually something that I wrote in the early 90s, which is inclusion means belonging. It means being a part of. It means making friends, smiling, laughing, learning, crying, caring for others, growing, and experiencing all the many facets of childhood. It simply means being a kid. And as many of you that are listening know, that many children with autism, based on their disability, wind up not having the opportunity to just be a kid. There's actually some work that's being done from Barry Prezant and Amy Weatherby, where they are stating that the exclusion of children with autism from typical developmental experiences is creating a secondary disability, which the effects of are perhaps greater than the negative effects of the primary disability of autism. And it makes a lot of sense. What they're saying is that we take these kids with autism at a very young age, and we provide a heck of a lot of therapy in isolated settings. And don't get me wrong, by any means, I'm not saying that intensive therapy isn't good for kids, but the question is, can we provide that intensive therapy in more natural settings? And I believe strongly the answer is yes. Anyhow, the idea here is that we take kids with autism at a young age and we take them out of their typical experiences and give them a lot of therapy, in a lot of clinics, hours and hours and hours. And we have to recognize, of course, that by doing that, there's only so much time in a day, we're taking away those opportunities to have more typical experiences. Well, the result of that is that children with autism aren't having those typical developmental experiences, which help in the development of typically developing kids. We know that if you take a child without autism, a neurotypical child, and you give them a very low stimulus life in the early years, they enter kindergarten without the same level of skill set and maturity in their development as those children who had more intensive experiences, more in terms of preschool or Mommy and Me classes or Head Start programs, mm-hmm. as opposed to those kids who didn't have those experiences. So then you take a child with autism who already has a difficult time taking in the information around them, who already has a difficult time getting the most from the environmental stimuli that's out there for them, and we don't give it to them. It only makes sense that they are not going to reach the same developmental milestones as neurotypical children who are having those experiences. So I think I believe strongly that we need to always be looking at how can we best include children and how can we get those needs met, if it's physical therapy or occupational therapy or speech-language therapy or behavioral therapy, in a more natural environment. And there's been some extremely innovative people out there who have created some great strategies and great ways of making sure that kids are getting those supports in the natural environment without the need for artificial types of settings.
Right. Well, that's a great, really, really great explanation. And how would you like to get started with some questions?
That would sound great. Give my voice a break here. That sounds great.
Well, I think there were a couple people that submitted questions beforehand. You want to hit some of those, or we had probably about another 20 that came in while you were speaking.
Okay.
So,
you want to just? I read over them, and they were all fine questions. So, if you just want to read them out loud, I'll take a breather while you read the question, and I'll go ahead and answer it.
Sure. Really good. Let's see here. I'm going to start one. I think it's Elizabeth from Concord. My son with autism is in high school. Electives are the courses where he should have a choice. Unfortunately, kids in the special ed class were rejected in several mainstream classes due to lack of staff for chaperoning. My son was given only two options, teacher assistant or art 101, which he took last year. He is not interested in TA and does not want to repeat the course. We were told that the classes like dance, foods, art design, and yoga were full. What can we do as parents to fight for our kids' inclusion to certain classes? Regular students get to choose their electives with prior semester. Our children have to wait until we see what classes are not full or what teacher is willing to take them.
Is that the end of the question, Ernest?
I'm sorry?
Was that the end of the question?
That was the end of the question, yes. I guess the gist of the question would be to kind of rephrase it. Go ahead.
Oh, I got it. If you need to repeat it for the audience, I got the question. Do you want me to answer that, or do you want to rephrase that?
Oh, yes. Yes, please.
Do you know if that call came from the United States?
It said Concord, so that sounds like a U.S. name of some kind.
Concord, yeah. It's the Bay, there's a Concord in the Bay Area here in California, at least.
That's it.
The answer to that question is, first of all, it's a simple answer. situation is extremely unfortunate. Under IDEA, under the federal law protecting children in educational programs, as well as under the American with Disabilities Act, kids with disabilities, autism included, have the same right to participate in those electives as any other child. So really you have a couple of options. One is just to tell the school that, you know, you get a choice, and to make sure they recognize that, that they need to give you that choice just like they give anybody else. And then the next thing you do is, if they refuse to do that, is to let them know that you believe it's a violation of that individual's civil rights. And if they, again, sometimes you need to start nicely, and sometimes you need to raise the ante a little bit, and then you need to make sure you follow through with the ante. If they don't comply, chances are that one of the worst things you can do to anybody is file a civil rights complaint, as far as the amount of paperwork it takes and the amount of time it takes to clear that up. Or to deal with the ramifications if you're proven to have violated civil rights. That is clearly a violation of civil rights. If the child is participating, is enrolled in that school, they have the right to participate in those electives. And if they are saying that the kids without disabilities get first choices, they're not even saying, it doesn't sound like they're saying to me, that it's not educationally appropriate, which then could be an educational argument. What I'm hearing is that, in that question, is that the other kids get first choice and we'll give you what's left. And that's an absolute violation of civil rights. So, again, what I would do in that situation is first make sure the director, the principal at the school knows, and the director of special ed knows that that's not acceptable to you. If that doesn't fix the problem, then I would let them know that's not acceptable to you. And if you believe it's a violation of your child's civil rights, and you will file a civil rights complaint if they don't fix it. And if they don't fix the problem, then the third thing I would do is file a civil rights complaint. That's a pretty black and white one. Civil rights would probably pick it up in a second. And then the ramifications of that is that the school would have a full system change to make sure they're not violating civil rights of anybody at that school, which isn't a bad thing when they're doing things like that, because that sounds almost like a culture of the school, which is not understanding the importance of making available everything to all kids. So the end thing would be, and I think it would, the very last one, which I believe would be effective, would be to go to the Office of Civil Rights and file a complaint. But I would give the school an opportunity to fix the problem before you did that, because it's not a very brief.
You know, this comes up quite a bit with many of our parents, because some of them say, you know, I don't necessarily have money for an attorney, but, you know, I want to know the next best thing that I can do. So for what I hear you saying is, it's you know, you can certainly file a complaint with the Civil Rights Office, but also to talk to the principals in a way that kind of gets them to kind of be on your side. I'm figuring that's what you most people want to do.
Exactly. You don't want to make the first thing you want to do is be a team player and be collaborative, even if somebody's upsetting you and creating a situation which is causing harm to your child. Lots of times we get angry, which we should, and it's understandable. But the first thing is to give them an opportunity to correct it. And the next thing to do is give them an opportunity to recognize what the consequences will be if they don't correct it. Nice thing about, you know, about filing a civil rights complaint is that that's free. You don't need an attorney for that one. They have their own attorneys who look into that for you. You have several issues at the school. If it's an educational related issue, meaning that the school is in a difference of opinion as to what's educationally appropriate, that most likely wouldn't be a civil rights issue. But in this situation, it sounds like they're making a blanket statement by saying that, you know, kids in the regular education program get first choices at electives, and kids in the special day classroom program get second choices at elective. And then you've created a second class system, which is absolutely an issue of civil rights. If they were saying to you that you wanted your child to participate in a woodshop, and they said they felt like it wasn't appropriate for safety issues or educationally relevant to the child, that would fall under IDEA, which is the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which is a much harder, that's more subjective. Civil rights is a little more black and white. IDEA is a little more subjective.
Sure. Well, I want to say that you're a hero to Elizabeth today, because she just posted a note on the message board here of the questions, and she says, yes, I'm from California. Thanks for answering my question, Rick. I have been told I will open Pandora's box, but I'm willing to do it. We are definitely set up an appointment with the principal. So Good job.
Excellent. Good. I like these teleconferences. Hey, well, we can get immediate feedback like that. I'll come on here every week, Ernest. That's great.
Yeah, it's really interesting. So, matter of fact, we've got a couple of comments from people. We're up to 44 questions now, so it's as we go along. Let's see here. What I'll do is maybe I'll mix up one question that, you know, a question that just came in. Here we have Kim McLean from Long Beach, California. Her question is, can you request an extracurricular activity for elementary school children?
Can you request extracurricular activity for elementary children?
Yes.
Can you request the, I guess it's hard because she's not there, it's a written question. Let me answer that the way I think that's being asked. Extracurricular activities, there's two kinds of extracurricular activities, basically. If we're going to put these into categories, there's school-sponsored extracurricular activities, and there's non-school-sponsored extracurricular activities. Regarding school-sponsored extracurricular activities, meaning that the school is organizing this activity, then absolutely you can request that the child participate in that and receive the supports necessary to help them participate in that through the school. Now, what's important to recognize is just because something's happening on the school campus doesn't mean that it's school-based extracurricular activity. So let me give you an example. If there's a football group or a football team or a dance group that practices after school, even though the school might have assisted by sending out flyers and even though that might be occurring on the school campus, the school district may not be involved in the operation of it or the oversight of it, which would make it a non-educational extracurricular activity. In that sense, your best bet as far as getting support would be through regional center. Now, again, under the American with Disabilities Act, the child has the right to participate in that activity, but he may not be able to without the appropriate support. And that's where, coming from Long Beach, you'd call Harbor Regional Center. But just in general, you call Regional Center or the Department of Developmental Services in other states and look for support to participate in that. If it's a school-based extracurricular activity, such as science camp, your child's in sixth grade and going to science camp, that's very much a school-based activity. School dances are school-based activities. Sports games are school-based activities. School sports, if it's actually the school football team, the school basketball team, the school water polo team, et cetera. In that situation, the child should be able to participate and get support to be able to do that.
Mm-hmm. Very good. Let's see here. I got a question here from a woman named Holly who I spoke with today. She's from Michigan, and her question is my son, age 6, is ADHD/ODD/Asperger's. His IQ is 1 less than genius. He is bored stiff in kindergarten. He is reading, and they are learning their rights and lefts. What can I do, or what can be done to keep him stimulated?
Well, if he's bored because the curriculum is, I guess there's several reasons why he could be bored. It could be because the curriculum is too simple for him. It could be because he just has no interest in it, and there's different answers to those. If he's bored because it's too easy, basically, he already knows how to do all those things academically, and there's no challenge to it, then what any teacher should do is to provide some higher-level thinking on top of that. When we look at gifted or GATE programs, gifted intelligence programs in the schools, there's two kinds. There's the kind that pull the child out, again, kind of the opposite of inclusion on the other end of the spectrum there, and there's those where the teacher does what's called differential instruction, which means that that teacher meets that individual student's needs by providing higher level type of thinking embedded in the curriculum of what's going on. So as opposed to pulling him out of the kindergarten classroom, the teacher would give him some, if they feel like he's clearly mastered all that material and doesn't need to work on it, they would give him some higher level type of thinking to target that creative intelligence as a way of keeping him interested and keeping him learning. Because it's not just a matter of keeping interested, making sure we're maximizing his learning. If it's a matter that he's bored because it's of low interest to him, which is very common for many of our kids with autism, there's two sides of that. One is to try and embed interest into the curriculum and the activities that are going on in the classroom. But we also need to teach people as a matter of functioning in the world that they need to do those tasks even when they don't have no interest in them. All of us have to do parts of our job that we just don't like. For example, I absolutely love my job. I love what I do. But there's parts of it I'd rather not do. But I need to. It's just part of the job. And for kids to learn that is important. And so to help with the motivation might just be building in some behavioral motivational strategies to help the child to do those things that are of low interest. So again, to summarize that, one would be to embed more interest into the activity. So, for example, if the kids were working on their penmanship in kindergarten, and perhaps he had a real interest in an activity such as baseball, then perhaps he could work on his penmanship by writing letters related to baseball, or spelling the word baseball, or filling in a visual activity which was related to a baseball game with those letters they were working on. So we call that curriculum adaptation. And the other side of the motivational would just be behavioral systems to motivate the child to do that. Perhaps it would be a reinforcement system where the child completes the task, or on their path to completing the task, they get happy faces. And when they get 10 happy faces, he gets to go read his favorite baseball magazine, for example. So building in motivation to help him get through that task.
Mm-hmm. All right. Well, let's see here. I've been flipping through a couple of questions here. I've got one here from Tammy, and her question is it good for kids with Asperger's to sit in a designated seat separate from the other children in the inclusive classroom? What are the social implications of this for a child who wishes to make friends with others in the class?
Wow, I would say, to give a blanket answer, of course, nothing's 100%. It depends on the individual child. But to give a blanket answer, I would say, no, it's not good for the child to be isolated within the classroom. The idea of inclusion is the child is part of the classroom. The thing this is one of those long answered questions, just to warn everybody here, because I'm going to elaborate on this one. What the most common thing that we see that I see when I go into classrooms is a lot of our kids tend to have one-on-one assistants or one-on-one aides. And you walk into the classroom and the other kids are sitting in table groups with four kids at each table group. And then this child with autism is at their own table group with their aide. And the aide becomes the person who gives them directions, who gives them redirection, who disciplines them when they're not doing what they're supposed to be doing, who teaches them the skills they need to learn. And in that sense, the aide becomes the child's teacher. In doing that, the child is no longer a part of the classroom. The child is basically, the rest of the class is sitting in their table groups working with the teacher, and Johnny, who has autism, is in the back of the room with an aide or a different table with the aide working outside of the typical classroom. And what I tell people all the time on that one is he might as well be in a special day classroom at that point. If you're not part of the classroom activities, if you're not part of the classroom culture, our kids would do better in a special day classroom because then there'd be less stimulus, less distraction, less feeling different than being in the classroom and having a totally separate classroom activity going on. What inclusion means is the child is a part of the activity. They're a part of the classroom. They belong in that classroom. And we make the accommodations and modifications to help them be successful. So, first of all, we can talk about aides a lot, but, you know, we really want to minimize the use of aides, and we want to make sure we're careful with the role of the aide in the classroom. They should not be hovering over the child. They should not be sitting next to them. I'll talk more about that in a second. But we want to be careful with that. The child should be sitting in a place which is most effective for them, and clearly we want to try and have that be if the kids are sitting in table pods or table groups. We want Johnny to be in a table group, and we want to provide the behavioral support and the teaching of the peer support to help him be successful sitting there. If there's an aide in the classroom, our rule of thumb, and I have a lot of assistants, behavioral therapist assistants that work with me that go into classrooms and support, and our number one rule of thumb is that person never have a chair next to the child. We have an acronym we use, which is called MISGO, M-I-S-G-O. And what that stands for is move in, squat, get out, meaning that if that child needs support, you move in, you squat next to them, you provide the support you need, and then you move away. And why squat instead of sit in the chair? Because if you're squatting, You're more likely to want to get up on your out of that squatting position sooner than later, and so you're likely to not sit there. If you have a chair, what we have found is that people will wind up sitting there for a much longer period of time than is needed. We don't want to make our kids overly dependent. We want to provide the support they need, and then we want them to be with their friends, and we want to get out of there as soon as possible. I've had people say to me, well, what if the kid's a runner? I go into classrooms all the time. This is what I do for work. I go into classrooms all the time and see aides sitting next to kids, and they say, well, the kid's a runner. I need to sit next to him. And my answer to that is always, well, aren't you going to be faster at getting the kid if you're on your feet to begin with, especially as we get older and our knees get a little bit weaker? And so really, as a rule of thumb, I tell people, make sure that aide is not next to that child. That child should be in the classroom with everybody else, have a seat which is most appropriate to their learning. And we should provide this behavioral support to help that be successful. But that I went on a sidetrack there with the role of the aides, because it is such a pet peeve of mine. It's, if I had to choose the biggest area in inclusion for kids with autism of challenge, it would be the overuse and misuse of the instructional assistant in the classroom. The assistant really should be facilitating that child's independence in the classroom and should not be encouraging that child's dependence on them. Really, what I like to tell people now, what I like to put in IEPs, is that we don't even write one-on-one aides anymore. The aide is not there for the child. The aide should be there for the teacher. The teacher is responsible for that child's education. And the aide is there to support that teacher in supporting that child's education. So what that means is if the teacher needs that aide to go help that student for a little bit, the aide can move in and help that student for a little bit. If the teacher needs for that aide to take over the rest of the classroom so they could work with that child, they should do that. If the teacher needs the aide to go into the teacher workroom and adapt curriculum so that the child with autism has work that's at their independent work level and instructional work level, that's a big thing that they should be doing. But we need to avoid this one-on-one or this separation in the classroom, which frequently when kids are separated from the rest of the kids in the classroom, they have an aide next to them who's become their teacher, and that's not appropriate. If they're just sitting in a different seat, if that's what that question was, outside of the parameters of the rest of the kids, you know, I would say that's inappropriate. It's not just inappropriate for the child with autism. And again, every case is different. There might be a reason for this that I'm not familiar with, but generally speaking, that would be inappropriate. Not just socially damaging for the individual with autism, but the impression that leaves on the other kids in the classroom regarding people with autism or regarding that child with autism is negative. We need to model for the typically developing kids in the classroom that children with autism are not bad, they're not weird, they have some differences in the way they view the world and the way they process information in the world, and they have some strengths and they have some challenges just like the rest of us do. And by modeling that they could be in the classroom like everybody else with different types of support, like everybody else gets different types of support, we build better social understanding and better community understanding and tolerance and acceptance of human differences. By segregating within the classroom, where this becomes this real visual, symbolic separation, I would be afraid that we would create really negative impressions on the part of the neurotypical children.
Mm-hmm. That's true. That's very true. And it's, you know, the fact that they're inside, and I think kids tend to be more accommodating if they have compassion for someone that they're sitting right next to, you know, that they're part of, as opposed to sort of, you know, not seeing that. So they're not, I wouldn't say sympathy, but being accommodating to other students that are different than them.
Yeah, research actually shows that there's been lots of research done on teacher acceptance and modeling, and what we know is that the teacher who accepts the child as one of their students, who treats them like they treat the other students in the classroom, the other kids then get the same perception of that child as a teacher, meaning that if the teacher acts as though this is just another kid in the classroom, the kids view them as just another kid in the classroom. If the teacher views them as separate or different or isolates them, the kids will do that same thing.
Sure. Gotcha. Well, let's see here. We've got a couple more questions that have come in. One of them is from Diane from Minnesota, and her question is, what about kids with Asperger's in high school? Any suggestions to help with social skills in the high school setting?
Yeah, a couple of interesting. I'm out here in California, so I just have to say real quickly, because I just have to get my political spiel in here. I got a phone call from Minnesota and a phone call from Michigan. It's important that you guys get out there and vote. It's a big election as far as the effects on education. And I'm not going to tell you who to vote for, but as an educator, clearly we need to recognize that in the early 2000s, when Clinton left office, we had a surplus of money that even some Republican senators were saying we should be using to fund IDEA, which has never been fully funded. It's been funded, I think the most was 18% or so, where Congress promised 40%. And Senator Jefferson from Vermont, I believe, I think it was Vermont, who actually became an independent because he argued with the Bush administration that that money should be used to fund IDEA and not to give tax breaks to people who really didn't need them. And so to recognize that the election coming up is an important one as far as, especially with the Financial Times we're having and what kind of funding we're going to get for kids with disabilities and to recognize the importance of that, especially in states such as Michigan and Minnesota. My vote in California, although I'm obviously going to vote, doesn't mean as much, just because we're clearly leaning in a direction which is, which we believe would benefit education. Anyhow, let me say to that question, there's the nice thing, and I can't speak to Minnesota, but I have worked in high schools throughout the country, and most of them have opportunities which are great for social skills for kids on the autism spectrum, and that's a thing that we call social clubs. Most high schools have a list of social clubs, and the neat thing about, and these are clubs that meet at lunchtime, that meet after school, that meet on weekends, and they're clubs which revolve around an interest area. So, for example, you might have the Young Democratic Club or the Young Republican Club or High School Students for Obama Club or High School Students for McCain Club, or you might also have things such as a sports club or a sailing club or a baseball club or a horseback riding club or a reading club. I mean, they just have huge, huge list of clubs at many of these high schools' campuses. And what those clubs revolve around is a shared interest. And the important thing to recognize regarding social relationships for individuals with autism, well, for everybody, social relationships are based on shared interest. We have people that we socialize with based on that we share a similar love for the arts or similar love for a certain kind of music or political affiliation. These are the things that we talk about and we engage in. For kids with autism, they tend to have more limited interests, so it's harder to find those opportunities of people who have shared interests. And these clubs are rooted in an interest. So if you have them in Minnesota or anybody else that's listening, anywhere that you have a child going to high school, and some middle schools are starting to do more of this, more and more of this too, is most schools will have a list of their social clubs. Is get that list, work with your child on the ones that would be most interesting to them, and work with the school staff to make sure they go to those clubs to see what they're about. And what we find is that, wow, these are kids who are all interested in the same thing I'm interested in. And these clubs, although they might only meet once a week at school, the friendships come out of there, and the kids wind up doing activities far beyond the organized club time. And so where elementary schools generally don't offer those, high schools generally do. And what we have found is that, contrary to popular opinion, where people think that elementary is going to be an easier place to facilitate socialization, we've actually found that through being able to go directly to a place with kids that have this interest that I have, we've been able to do a much better job of facilitating socialization.
Sure.
Now, again, if you don't have those clubs, then I would look at what are the, and I hopefully you do, and if you don't have those clubs at your high school, I would look at what are the social activities that the kids are doing after school. Are they enrolled in other types of activities through Parks and Rec, through other community, through church or temple, and have them engage in that. What we know is that kids that hang out together in school are more likely to hang out together outside of school, and vice versa. Kids that hang out together outside of school are more likely to hang out together in school. So it's really beneficial to have our kids who already have social challenges to hang out, to participate in those activities after school, which their friends or the kids from school also participate in, as opposed to doing something totally separate. If a bunch of kids go to the local bowling league after school or participate in a park and rec program after school or a teen group through church, but those kids are also going to that high school, then we want to encourage our kid to do that, as opposed to if, you know, your church group is in a different community and none of those kids go to that high school, that might not be the best teen group to participate in. It might not be bad, but it would not be as good as participating in a teen activity group with kids that also go to that high school.
Gotcha. Hey, let's take a question here from India. Her name is Hema, and let's see here. She's actually listening in online right now, and she has you probably saw the initial questions that she asked because she inputted these in much earlier. She wanted to know sort of how to teach her child ABCs, and also wanted to know how she can help her 4-year-old son make friends who has autism. You kind of talk about certain clubs and so forth, but for a 4-year-old, I mean, what does a parent do? This might not be your area of expertise, so maybe you can shed some light on it for her.
You know, the challenge I would have with that question, again, is not understanding Indian culture as much as or the options that are available in India as much as the U.S., but I'll do my best bet and based on what we would do with the U.S., and then hopefully those similar types of options, or she could extrapolate from that to what would be available in the U.S., in India. In terms of making friends for a 4-year-old, that's very much the program that we have, which is our social play friendship development program. And the key is opportunity. And to find that opportunity. So what we tell parents all the time is, go. You know, do you have kids from your neighborhood? Do you have kids from church or temple? Do you have kids from family friends that we could arrange play dates with? And we always say start with a one-on-one play date. Large groups are typically more challenging for our kids with autism. Start with one-on-one and facilitate that play date and make sure you make it a positive experience for both kids. You know, do high-interest activities for both kids. Really, really be a cheerleader and really make it fun. But the first question is, where do you find those kids from? And you know, in the U.S., if the child's 4, I would really encourage the family to enroll them into a typical preschool. Be it a private preschool or be it a Head Start or state-sponsored preschool with typically developing kids, and then try and facilitate play dates with those kids outside of school. The other option I would say is look at community activities where typically developing kids go to. Maybe there's a young kids drama group, or maybe there's so many art classes or sports classes or Boy Scouts or after-school programs. And make sure that you go there with your child and you meet the other parents and you facilitate play dates. Church and temple works great as far as going where you're meeting other families and asking if their son or daughter can come over for a play date after school to facilitate that, to arrange that play date. So the first thing is identifying the peers and having access to the peers to form those friendships. And then the next one would be to facilitate that so it's a positive experience. And that's a whole, you know, 2-hour presentation we can give on how to do that. I'll just be real general and say you want it to be positive. It's not an ABC time. It's not an academic time. You know, in our program, maybe somebody might define it the best. In our program that we run, it is a social skill development program. But for the first month of the program, the only goal that we have is to have fun. We want the child to have fun. We want them to want to be there. We want them to look forward to those play dates. And after a month of just having fun, 2 things have happened. One is that they've already developed lots of play skills and social skills based on all the experiences they've had. And 2 is the motivation to be in those play dates is strong enough to override the challenges we put in that child by trying to get them to grow in areas that are difficult for them. So really, you know, so many families will want the child to immediately start working on something. And really, there's a big time in life where it's just important that kids have fun. And what we need to recognize from that is actually they learn more frequently by having positive social experiences than anything we can teach them. Social skills is the most complex thing we can teach a child. There's so many nuances. There's absolutely no way to predict exactly what another 4-year-old child's going to do. And so to teach that is nearly impossible. The best way for kids to learn social skills is by having lots and lots and lots and lots of experiences and social interactions with other kids.
Very good. Matter of fact, this kind of ties in with another question that I received from the initials were LJ in Old Orchard, Missouri, or Maine maybe. She wants to thank you for the clarifying the role of an aide. And she says, I'm trying to find the best way to help my 4.5-year-old son participate in his Sunday school class. It is probably not going to be possible for me to find him a separate helper. So how do I, as a mother, help myself lay off really teaching him how to behave, that is, respect his one's personal space, stay on task, and not appear different? Thank you for the acronym, by the way.
Oh, okay, great.
For the aide.
What was that?
For the aide.
For the aide, yeah, I assume she was talking about MISGO, the Move In Squad and Get Out.
Yes.
Yeah, and I love that. I love that acronym. I like to get pins that say MISGO or on it, because it's such a prevalent issue that we see in the schools. You know, not knowing the child, not knowing the degree of the challenges that he or she has makes it difficult to be specific. Of course, I could say that when we talk about inclusion, in a school type of situation or a club type of situation, and this one, let's say Sunday school, there's a Sunday school teacher, and we want that teacher to be the teacher. We want that teacher to take the ownership over the child and to be the one who gives the directions, who gives the redirection, who gives the prompts, who gives the support, who gives the discipline when needed. And to do that, we want to make sure we give her or him as many tools as possible. So I would start by, seeing if you can meet with the teacher, you should be able to, and really sit down with the teacher and explain, first of all, what you're trying to accomplish, what your goals are for the child in the setting, and then really help them to understand the unique needs of the child and what they can do to help support the child. The other supports in the classroom, again, looking at natural supports as opposed to artificial supports, are the kids. And I will tell you, it's probably one of the best things about this job that I get to experience are how great people are and how great kids are. And that's not just, and that's, I mean, we've seen 3- and 4-year-olds do amazing things in supporting our kids, and we've seen high school students, and yes, to everyone's surprise, middle school students, junior high school students, doing a fantastic job at supporting our kids. The key to that is education. Is education. If we educate the typically developing kids at that Sunday school, at high school, at elementary school, about the child and about what that child needs to be successful, the kids will step up to the plate and do an amazing job. The reality is you get a kid in there with significant challenges of some sort, proximity challenges, whatever they may have been, and you don't provide any support, he's going to have a really hard time. But it doesn't mean that you necessarily need to bring in an artificial support such as an aide or the parent needs to go with the child. The teacher and the peers can provide great levels of support as long as they have the information to do so. As far as the peers, we have this thing that we call ability awareness, really making kids aware of the different child strengths and challenges. And I go a step further, and let me go on elaborate a little bit further on to this one, because it's an extremely important area. When we're including kids with autism, it's imperative that the typically developing peers, the neurotypical peers, know about the child and aware of the child. I have families say to me, we talk about ability awareness, and we say the first thing is education. And families will say, well, I don't want to stigmatize my kid. And what I have to respond 99.9% of the time is, have you seen your child in the classroom? The behaviors which are characteristic of kids with autism, which generally kids with autism, the different types of behaviors that kids with autism demonstrate, are perceived by kids who are unknowledgeable as being weird, as being different. They stigmatize themselves. If the kids don't have the understanding of what's going on, and by providing knowledge, the kids go, oh, okay, I understand that, and then it's no big deal. And it's amazing. We see the kids go from basically shunning the child because here's this kid that they perceive as weird in their classroom, and they stay away from them, to once they have an education about the child, embracing them. And it speaks to the power of education. There's a great bumper sticker I saw years ago, and I've seen it many times since, which is, prejudice is ignorance, and I think it's so true. We prejudge people when we're ignorant, and when we have knowledge and education, we don't prejudge people anymore. and that's so important for our kids with autism. And then the step further I would go with that, which is, so the first thing is education. Make kids aware of the strengths and challenges of the individual with autism. But then, and lots of people who do ability awareness stop then. Your typical ability awareness lesson plan would be where you talk about human differences and you talk about how we all have strengths and weaknesses. And you ask all the kids to share some of the things they're good at and some of the things they're not good at. And then and the child with autism, either if they can speak for themselves or if they can't, a parent or a teacher explains what that child is good at and has challenges at. And then we say we should all get along. And that's typically where we leave it. I like to take it a step further. I do take it a step further. I think it's important that we take it a step further. And that's where we elicit support from those kids and what those challenges are. And not just for the kid with autism, but if we say, here's the challenges that we've identified. What can we do as a community now? We're a Sunday school classroom community. We're a second grade classroom community. Whatever it is, we're a Boy Scouts community. Whatever it is, what can we do as this community now? Because we have a responsibility. We should be teaching kids that they have a responsibility to support people who have that need, be it because they have autism or be it because they have emotional challenges or be it because they have financial challenges. We should be supporting each other in order to make a better world. And so for the individual with autism, we say, what can we do to help support this child as a group, as a community here? And we don't just leave it at education, but we actually elicit support. We take a step further to actually elicit support. And so let me give you an example of what that might look like. It's not uncommon for a child with autism when a kid says hello to them for them to keep walking and to not acknowledge that child. The adult, frequently, if we're walking by and we say hi to Johnny and Johnny doesn't respond, we might require a response in order of teaching him appropriate social skills and social greetings. The typical kids might say hi to be nice, and then Johnny doesn't answer back and they just keep going. And basically what that's teaching Johnny is that behavioral teaching is that I don't need to respond. Someone says hi to me, I don't respond. It's no big deal, I don't want to respond, and there's no consequence to me for not responding. So to elicit the support from the kids, if that's a pivotal behavior we want to work on, we would tell the kids, when you say hi to Johnny, stop walking. Say hi to Johnny. If he doesn't respond, get inside of his personal space. Get inside of his proximity and say, hi, Johnny. And if he doesn't respond, get right up to him and say, Johnny, I said hi. And don't allow a non-response to occur. And what we know is that if we've got 30 kids, every time they say hi to Johnny, requiring a response, Johnny's going to learn to respond. And as opposed to if it's just the adult doing it, Johnny will learn that when I say, Johnny, respond to me, he'll respond. But he won't respond to anybody else. But what happens is as we get more and more people being consistent in that, he starts to generalize outside of those people. And so then he starts to respond to the 30 kids plus the additional 30 kids he meets in his life and other environments. He learns to respond, and he generalizes that skill, and now he learned that skill. And so peer education and eliciting peer support is a critical part of making inclusion work.
Good. Great way to explain that. And that brings me to another question here, and that's we have a woman named Jessica from Kona, Hawaii, I guess. And I heard you explain this before, and you did such a great job at this. Her question was, how do I make school less stressful? My six-year-old shuts down at school and obsesses over it at home, and she's also very withdrawn at school and severely frustrated at home. How can I keep the violence of this child at a minimum when she's at home? But I know you talked about a checklist at one time for parents to take, or a to-do list for parents to take when they take their kids back to school. Maybe that might help her.
Yeah, I think there's many ways that and we need to look at that as a serious issue. I think the first thing, and no offense to the folks in Michigan or Minnesota, but Jessica, I'd be happy to come out to Kona and provide personal support on that one, to come out and consult individually on that one. Of course, I would be happy to go to Michigan, too. It's a neat place. But Kona might be my first one on that list. I think it's important for everyone to recognize that school is hard. And with the standards movement, which is now a national movement, school has become much more difficult. And it's not just the content. It is the It is the intensity of the flow of the day. Teachers in the U.S. are under such pressure to build test scores that they are just 100%, they have been forced to be 100% academically driven. Where 10, 15 years ago, we were looking at the whole child, today we're forced to look more at the academic child. And what that means as far as what the day looks like, whereas 10 or 15 years ago, we'd give an assignment, we'd say, okay, when you're finished, there's a free box activities, you can go do that. And some kids would have 5 or 10 minutes of downtime before the next activity came up. Well, these days, it's everyone's doing the same thing. They're on the same time frame. They work until, you know, the subject ends, and then, boom, they go right to the next subject. And it becomes an extremely intense day for our kids with autism. And there's no time to really to relax. And then what happens, as Jessica pointed out, is the child tries so hard all day to hold it together because of the social pressures and the peer pressures to hold it together that when they get home, they explode because they are absolutely overwhelmed. They are absolutely overstressed. So the thing we have going for us is that even though the country is going has been on a standards movement of intense academic focus, we still have IDEA, the Individuals with Disabilities Education Act, which supersedes all of the state laws on education, basically meaning that we can individualize a child's educational program and provide accommodations and supports to help that child be successful. So what I would say to all families is, although as a nation we have moved towards looking primarily, almost entirely, at the academic child, it's for our kids with autism that we have the opportunity, the legal opportunity and availability, to still look at the whole child and to make sure that we're doing that. We need to look at the whole child. We need to say, okay, academics are important, and I want him to do the best he can, but I also need to look at his overall well-being and make accommodations to allow that to happen. So, you know, there's a plethora of strategies to reduce the academic stress. I'll tell you a couple of them, and one is basically to adapt the material. So these days, like I said, the kids go right from one activity to the next with no downtime. And to adapt the activity so that what's built in for the child with autism is some downtime, so that we believe that if we adapt it in this way, he or she should be able to finish the activity 5 minutes before it's over and then move on to the next act, and then have 5 minutes of downtime where they could decompress, maybe engage, maybe participate in a preferred activity, and then be ready to move on to when the subject changes with the transitional prompt. Mm-hmm. The other area that we talk about is recess. And Tony Atwood has said before, I've heard him say several times, that that you know, and it's true that for kids with autism or Asperger's syndrome, keeping it together in school is so hard that at recess time, we really need to be careful and just let them chill. I agree with the first part, disagree with the second part, which is that we just need to let kids chill at recess. Autism is very much, and what we're finding more and more, and what's becoming more and more agreed upon in the professional community, is that autism is a social disorder in its root. And in the old days, where we had a lot more time to work on social skills at school, these days the only opportunity we have to work on social skills is really recess and lunch. And for most kids, that's maybe 40 minutes a day. So as opposed to allowing them to decompress at lunch and recess, I believe those need to be instructional opportunities. Lunch and recess need to be instructional opportunities in the area of social development. Therefore, we take the child out of the academic periods, which are a lot longer in a day. There's a lot more opportunities for academics in the day, and take the child out of the academic periods to allow them to decompress. So, for example, if we're in math and after math is recess, potentially 10 or 15 minutes or 20 minutes, depending on the child's needs, before recess, the child would be able to stop their math activity and get their own recess time, because for them recess isn't truly recess. It's learning and education, so they can have their own downtime to engage in an activity which is of highest preference to them, and then be ready to learn during recess. So I think the primary answer to Jessica's question is to make sure that built into the child's day, there are opportunities to decompress, there's opportunities to relax, and for the school to recognize how difficult it is for an individual with autism to stay engaged, how much mental energy and physical energy goes into that for a child with autism for a full 6 or 7 hour day.
All right. Okay. Man, oh man, so many new questions here. It's kind of hard to pick out the ones that are coming in. We're up to 62 now. Let's see here. I'm going to sort of read this question. Hopefully it will make sense as I read it. And it's from Carolyn from New Jersey. And her question is, our son is 5 and just started a new autism school. He is doing great there, but hates the bus. I think it is the bus drivers that he's afraid of. I can drive him to school, but I'm afraid he will learn that if he fusses, he will get me to do what he wants. So I want to keep having him take the bus. How can I make this transition smoother for him? He starts to get upset about 10 minutes before she arrives, and he starts begging me to drive him and pick him up. Any suggestions? I don't know if that's in your area or not, but she sounds very concerned about this.
I didn't quite get, maybe you could paraphrase the part for me. Why is he having problems on the bus? Why does he not want to go on the bus?
She says that he might, I think it sounds like he's afraid of the driver.
Okay. So if that's the case, basically he wants to ride the school bus. He's afraid of the bus, or she wants him to. He's afraid of the bus driver. If it's the bus driver or the bus or whatever might be going on, it sounds like we need to do some desensitization training, which is behavioral techniques to get him more comfortable in that situation. Again, we could do a whole 2-hour training on desensitization techniques. I would recommend that, you know, she look into that and how we desensitize kids to fears, to environments and activities which create fear for the child. You know, some things that are pretty common in the area of autism would be social stories. So read a social story about the bus or the bus driver on a daily basis. The other one would be to have him have a positive interaction with the bus driver, so it's not so for whatever was scaring him is not scary. You know, it's one of those situations where when it comes to behavioral intervention, we have to do much more significant analysis to be able to determine what is the cause of the behavior, what is the cause of the fear. And then we determine interventions based on that. I think, again, for in generally speaking, for kids with autism, is familiarity. And the unknown is usually pretty scary for our kids, and they have a difficult time processing new information, so the unknown is even that much more scary. And so really trying to do some priming, some desensitization in that situation, you know, maybe being able to go on the bus, you know, at the end of the day when the bus is empty and all the kids are gone, maybe go to the bus yard and work it out with the bus yard director that he can just go onto a bus, walk around on the bus, get comfortable on the bus, meet the bus driver if possible before, you know, at the end of the day or beginning of the day, whatever it might be. Again, really going back to the desensitization types of stuff.
Sure. Okay, we have one question which I think probably affects a lot of parents here, and I'm going to take a 2-minute break while you answer this question because I have to go to another room here, but I'll give you the question. Should you remove a child who has experienced a tantrum or work through it in the classroom?
During the tantrum. Would you think, Ernest, the question is during the tantrum, would you remove the child or work through it?
Yes.
Okay. Again, that goes back to the behavioral question and the behavioral strategy, and the reason those are more difficult to answer, and I'll answer the question in pretty longly, so I give Ernest plenty of time. Is you want to make sure that you're not reinforcing the inappropriate behavior. The challenge with behavior is that children are engaging in the behavior for a reason. They're communicating something for their behavior. They're trying to get a need met, and that behavior is communicating what that need is, even though we might not be able to know what that is. That's why we do functional analysis assessments to really determine what is the child communicating through that behavior. And the problem why you can't say, yeah, always remove the child or always not remove the child is because you don't want to inadvertently reinforce the behavior. By reinforce the behavior, what I mean by that is increase the occurrence of it in the future. Just a real quick behavior 101, reinforcement means, to reinforce something means, the only way we know if we're reinforcing it, if it's increasing the occurrence of it. And so, for example, the child that's rolling around on the floor having a tantrum because they don't want to be there, and then we remove the child from the environment, meaning the child was demonstrating a communicative function that we might call escape. The child didn't want to be there. They wanted to escape from there. They're rolling around having a tantrum on the floor. We then remove them from the room. We then basically, we then gave them what they wanted, and in essence, we most likely reinforce the behavior, which means that the child will be more likely to roll around on the floor and have a tantrum when he doesn't want to be there. So that's, there's a huge problem with that. On the other hand, if the kid's having a tantrum because he's physically uncomfortable, there's something that went on earlier that day, and he needs a break to decompress and maybe talk about that, but really wants to be in the classroom, he's just, you know, over the top with whatever's going on, then removing the child to be able to decompress and to be able to practice some calming techniques and to be able to maybe talk about, if he can, what had gone on and what's going on would be totally appropriate. So much of it depends on what the function of the behavior is. The key here, and this is the key. And if, when we look at behavior in any setting, but definitely behavior in an inclusive setting, is to minimize the occurrence of the behavior in the future. So our goal, mm-hmm. when we're looking at a behavior, our goal should always be to minimize the occurrence of the behavior in the future, meaning the interventions that we put into place should be interventions that are likely to decrease the likelihood of that behavior occurring again in the future. Unfortunately, what we often do is just try and solve the immediate problem. The problem with that is that we inadvertently may be making that problem so it occurs more often again in the future, and that's a problem. And that's a problem. So we need to be really careful about what the intervention is. By no means should we automatically take a child out and show, by no means should we automatically leave a child there. We need to be analyzing what's going on and then intervening appropriately so that the behavior is less likely as opposed to more likely to occur again in the future.
Right. Okay. I have another question here from Johnny from Concord, Kansas. And it's an interesting situation he has here. He says that in wanting to include our children with autism into our community, myself and a teacher with a degree in special education have offered to meet with local doctors, city employees, fire department employees, etc., to have a roundtable discussion on what we think would be beneficial information to them in case they ever have an encounter with a child with autism. We have been denied any type of meeting. What advice can you give me in trying to make this happen? I'm a parent of a 6-year-old child with autism who just happened to try to call 911 a few weeks ago when I was ill with the flu. So I feel this would benefit area services, making them aware of what they might encounter.
Yeah. First of all, I commend him. That's an excellent mission to take up, extremely important mission to take up, and we're seeing it happening more and more. Again, as our kids with autism are in the community more often, the community needs to be, especially those community service providers, need to be best able to interact with that child and deal in an appropriate manner. We are seeing more and more of that occurring. We're seeing, especially among law enforcement, at least in California, we're seeing, I'm part of actually a panel to where we different professionals go in based on the topic and provide presentations to law enforcement in the area of autism. And so it's something we're seeing more and more occurring, and it's extremely important. Unfortunately, it tends to be triggered by a crisis. There's a community, and especially in smaller communities, there's a community that I work in where basically there was a crisis situation and it wasn't responded to appropriate. And so that became the impetus for law enforcement or firefighters to be able to get that type of training. Fortunately, we would hope that would not be the case, that we wouldn't need to have something unfortunate happen for us to be able to get the support in the community from those city officials and city workers, et cetera, and community service people. So on that, I guess I would say a couple. There's a group out here which has been fantastic, and you might want to Google them. They're called Special Needs Network. It's a group that was started by actually two parents that I've worked with before. One of them I still work with. to provide resources in the inner city of Los Angeles. And what they did was they basically said that, hey, there's a real discrimination here in lower income and minority areas of Los Angeles between the haves and have-nots, where kids with families and kids with autism are getting support in these communities, but in these lower income communities they're not. And they started this nonprofit group that has done a lot of community outreach for the community. And part of what they've done and been successful with is getting community service personnel to get the training in those communities to be able to interact with individuals with autism when they encounter them in the community. So they'd be some great people to talk with. Again, it's called Special Needs Network, and there might be several of them.
Yes, I just Googled it here.
What was that?
I just Googled it.
And did it come right up?
For those of you that have a pen and pencil, it's specialneedsnetwork.net. That is www.specialneedsnetwork.net.
And I recommend emailing them and asking them about strategies to specifically to your question, but I think it's a great question for all the listeners. As we look at kids with autism being included in the community, we need to make sure that our community service personnel have the skills and knowledge to interact with our kids as situations arise, and they'd be a good people to be able to do that. I could tell you what I'm familiar with, the way they've done that, is to get community attention onto the issues, to connect with a legislator that had some connection with this, so to get politics involved. And they basically found, you know, I don't know how many, but they found at least one. I think there were several legislators that they had found who had some connection to disabilities or autism, who were able to put pressure then on. They had some type of authority or definitely some type of connection with law enforcement and firefighters and other community services people to be able to get them to come on board with these types of trainings. So I think, again, connecting with your legislators. The good thing that we have going for us right now is that autism has gathered and gained a lot of attention within communities. There's been a lot more focus on autism in periodicals, through different groups, on news shows, so it's being talked about a lot more, and that's a great start to get us into a place where in the community we can get these supports for different organizations.
Mm-hmm. Let's see here. We got a couple more that have come in. Let's see here. This is a person, Fran, in New York. Her question is, can a child be a part of inclusion if language is very delayed compared with their peers? If so, why do schools put kids in special ed classes instead of regular ed classes? Does behavior play some role or intelligence level? My son is going to be 4, and he has PDD. He's reading at a 6-year-old level, but expressive language is poor. Talking to other parents' experiences with public school programs, inclusion is never an option or thought for some of these children by teachers or school officials. They're placed in special ed program, usually 12-to-1 program. So I guess their question seems to be, what about language placing them in sort of special ed classes?
Yeah, I think the simple answer to your question is absolutely. Absolutely, children with language challenges, which most kids with autism do have language challenges, including those kids who are completely nonverbal, can, and in many cases, in most cases, should be included with their typically developing peers. When we look at language development, the most important thing about language development, for most kids, the most important component of language development is, again, opportunity, is exposure to good language models. So it has always frustrated me and made very little sense to me that a child who has difficulty in the area of language, we put them into a classroom with other kids who have difficulty in the area of language, and hence, there are no good language models other than the adults, who really aren't the best language models, because we talk very different than how a 4-year-old or a 6-year-old or a 10-year-old talks, to be modeling language after. Of all of the challenges, it seems like language is one where we know there's so much research on language development which says, you know, exposure to good language models. And so, therefore, segregating kids doesn't make a lot of sense to me. It absolutely does not limit a child's language, a child's cognition, a child's social skills, a child's physical abilities regarding toileting, etc., do not limit that individual from being included. And there's plenty of case law to support that. And even behavior, we need to, you know, behavior eventually can limit a child if we've done the appropriate behavioral interventions and the child is still causing significant distractions to the learning of the other kids. Then the school district may be able to, in that situation, remove the child from the general education classroom. But language, social skills, cognition does not limit a child. Those are not prerequisites for placement into a general education classroom. In fact, you know, IDEA clearly states that academic ability, grade level performance is not a requirement for placement in a chronologically age-appropriate classroom. It's our job as the professionals and the adults in the child's world to provide the adaptations to help that child be successful. Now you go to the second part of that question from the way I heard it, which was, well, the district is not offering that for these kids. You know, even in states that, even here in California, where we've definitely progressed in the area of inclusion, we're still behind in the other states, but we've definitely progressed. The majority, the overwhelming majority of kids that are included with autism, the request for inclusion came from the parent, not from the school district. And it's a pet peeve of mine and a frustration of mine, because we've gotten to the point where we've seen thousands and thousands of kids with autism be successfully included. But too often school districts will still stick with their old philosophy, which is special day classroom, and the parent needs to be the one who says, I want the child to be included. Now, fortunately, in many areas, once the parent says they want the child to be included, the school will go along with that without too much of a fight. But from a legal point of view, or I should say more from a practical point of view, an educational point of view, what I always advise parents is, if you believe your child should be included and you want your child to be included, when you go to that IEP meeting, don't make your fight about the child being included. Make your fight about what supports are you going to get for your child to be successfully included. And what I mean by that is to use what we call the assumptive approach. Assume that, you know, the child's going to be included. This district, really, legally speaking, it's very difficult to say, for a school district to say based on case law and the interpretation of IDEA, that this child can't be included. But what many families make the mistake about is they spend all of their energy fighting to get the kid included. Then the kid gets included but doesn't have the support to help that child be successful in the inclusive placement. So really go into that IEP with the assumption that he's going to be in general ed. Now the question is, how are we going to support him in general ed? What are we going to provide to help him be, him and the teacher, or her and the teacher, be successful in general education?
Gotcha. Really good. I've got another question here from Nicole that's just exactly in this area you just discussed regarding the IEP. And then her question was, can you suggest some example of goals to include in the IEP for increased success in socialization with peers?
You know, goals really need to be, it's a great question, and first let me say that I gave a presentation the other day to a school district, and I told the school district, which I've said many times before, if we have a child with autism in the educational program, you know, there better be a really good reason why there isn't a social goal in that IEP. autism is a social disability, IDEA in many ways. IDEA includes social development as part of the educational needs of children with disabilities. Therefore, there's every child, you know, pretty much every child with a diagnosis of autism should have an IEP goal addressing social skill development, socialization. Now, on that note, what goals would be right? There is a plethora of them. They're unlimited. And again, it needs to be based on the individual child. You know, it might be initiation goals. It might be language socialization goals. It might be expansion of interest goals. You know, the list goes on and on and on. So I have to actually see the child and know the child and assess the child to say what type of goals should we write. But I will say that every child with autism pretty much should have a social goal in their IEP. And if you were to go and, again, go on Google and Google social domain goals, social domain, because we call that a domain as far as education, social domain IEP goals and objectives, you'd probably get lists of them. There are resources which many school districts put out of recommended goals which are just hundreds of goals in different areas, and there'd be no shortage of finding those social goals. The important thing is that they're focused on that individual child and they're meeting that individual child's needs. I will tell you one goal that I write in our social program, which is not our school. We write the same goal for many of our school kids, but through our regional center program or, you know, our developmental Department of Developmental Services programs, a goal that we write for almost all of our kids with autism is expansion of interest, expansion of interest. And the reason for that is because kids with autism tend to have more limited interests. And as I said earlier, our social relationships are based on shared interests. Our kids with autism tend to have limited interests, and as they get older, those interests don't change, so they become developmentally immature interests or developmentally inappropriate interests. And so therefore they have much less in common as they get older with another 14-year-old. Maybe at age 5 they have not as much in common because they have limited interests, but the interests they do have would be interests of another 5-year-old. But if those interests don't change when our kids hit 10, 11, 12, et cetera, they become to have no shared interests with their typically developing peers. So we do a lot of expansion of interest. What's important to know is that kids with autism are not neurologically boring at all. The reason I believe that most kids with autism have limited interests is because they have a difficult time processing the world around them, and that causes discomfort and anxiety. So when that happens, anybody would like to stay where they're safe, right? If newness right. is difficult for me, I'm going to stay where I'm safe. I'm going to stay with the same. If I'm staying with the same, I'm not going to be able to have new experiences, which are going to help me to expand my interests. And so we do all kinds of interventions to make kids feel comfortable, to use motivational strategies, to help kids try new things. And what we find is, just like with typically developing kids, when a child tries new things frequently, not always, like all of us, frequently they will like it and they'll get a new interest and they'll expand their interest. So that is the one goal that I would kind of say universally is important for most of our kids. Other than that, there's thousands of them, and but kids should have social goals in their IEP.
Okay. Really good. We've got, let's see here. We've got one question here again from Holly in Clinton, Michigan. And her question is, who do I need to contact to introduce coping skills for my son and my husband and I? I don't feel like he's getting taught coping skills. He is constantly in trouble, basically in trouble more than not.
Well, if it's school-based, I'm about to sneeze. Excuse me, everybody.
No problem. I've done it too.
If it is school-based, you probably talk to your school psychologist. Might be the first person to talk to, because they might have more skills in that area. But if there's an autism specialist on campus, or just a counselor, or another special educator who might have knowledge in that area, you would talk to them about strategies to teach coping skills. The other people that are working on coping skills these days actually are occupational therapists, as far as engine speed and helping kids to regulate when they go into deregulation. So really there's a list of people that you could talk to. Certain individuals have more knowledge than other individuals. You might find one OT who knows very little about coping skills and another OT or occupational therapist who knows a ton about coping skills.
Right.
Most school psychologists should have some knowledge in coping skills. So that might be your safest bet. And most people who specialize in autism should have some knowledge about coping skills and regulating and dealing with deregulation. So there should be a list of people. As far as outside of the school system, unfortunately I'm not aware. I'm not familiar enough with the system in Michigan to know who to go to. But I would, again, go to the school and say, we're having real issues with deregulation and coping strategies at the home. Is there somebody in the community that we can consult with that you might know of? They're going to be more familiar with community. If you're not, they're going to be more familiar with community resources outside of the educational system just by working, in collaboration with them.
Okay. I've had one person here ask me to repeat the website before. I believe it was www.specialneeds.com. specialneedsnetwork.net, because people had apparently had missed that, And so I wanted to repeat that again. And let's see here. I've got, here we go. I've got a question here from Florida. Let's see here. My child is overwhelmed in the cafeteria. He often ends up underneath the table with a book. He puts a book, apparently has a book to help soothe himself, and he's unable to stay in his seat the whole time and in class and is losing reward points because of my child's inability to sit still. What strategies might I suggest to help him deal with this sensory overload that happens in the school cafeteria? So I guess her son stays in the cafeteria, is really overwhelmed, and what can she do to help him with this sensory overload that occurs?
Well, let me first share that he's not alone. There are a lot of, and I'll explain why in a minute, but I work with a lot of kids with autism spectrum disorder who are overwhelmed in the cafeteria. First of all, the cafeteria tends to be extremely loud. There are a lot of kids. There's a lot of commotion. And the other thing
food
is
fights.
Food fights. And the architecture of cafeterias tend to be high roof and echoey. And so what we see in lots of school cafeterias, again, I haven't been in Florida much, but throughout California architecture at schools, the cafeterias tend to be very echoey the way they are built. And so you have all of that noise vibrating and echoing off of the walls, and it just becomes sensorily very difficult for our kids. A couple of different options. If it is auditory, which it tends to be with a lot of our kids, I actually have kids that wear earphones over their ears to reduce the noise level. I've got several kids that we've done that with. They actually are those. You could buy them at a shooting range, for example, a sports store, and they're the silence. They minimize certain frequencies, and people use them in shooting ranges and stuff. They minimize certain frequencies, and it tends to help a lot of our kids with autism. Now, the question might be, is he going to wear, these earmuffs in the cafeteria? Is going to stand out? Again, my answer would be, if he's crawling under the table in the cafeteria, he's probably standing out. Yeah, and so it goes back to peer education. He's got real sensitivity to a lot of noise or high-pitched sounds, and therefore, when we go into this very loud environment, we're going to have him wear this headset to reduce the sound. We've had a lot of luck. It's one of those things when you look at kids with autism, and they're all so different, and therefore the strategies we use are all so different. That happens to be one of those strategies which tends to be more universal. Those kids who are having a difficult time in the cafeteria, we give them the option of wearing this headset and these earmuffs, and they seem to just, okay, no problem anymore. It's worked really well. Of course, we could also give the kid an iPod or a Walkman to play music if that's the issue. I'm going to guess if that's the environment that's happening in it, it's most likely the noise level that's very difficult for the child. So something to muffle the sound, and like I said, the earmuffs is one way where the child muffles the sound, but the child could still actually engage in conversation, as opposed to an iPod or something with headpiece, where the child would be listening to music and should fade out the rest of the sound, but would make it more difficult for them to engage during that interaction. The other option would be to have an alternative place where the child and a small group can go to eat their lunch if the cafeteria was just so overwhelming that they could not deal with it. I would not want the child to go by themselves. Lots of kids probably would be happy. I know lots of kids are happy to eat somewhere other than the chaos of the cafeteria. And the teacher could open up their classroom, or the office could open up an area of the school where kids can go and eat lunch. And again, that this child or the child with autism, whoever he or she may be, would have the opportunity to go with some other kids to an area outside of the cafeteria to eat.
Well, what sort of talk, if you will, about what things are going on in the what new things are happening in your area of expertise? Anything new that you'd like to let parents know about today?
God, there's so much. In the area of autism and inclusion, we're learning so much constantly. We're learning new strategies, new techniques, new understandings. the whole in school, the whole concept of accommodations and modifications, I think is very important. There's been a lot of growth in that area. I'll talk about that for a minute.
Okay.
The difference between accommodations and modifications. So let me actually go to help guide me. I'm going to go to a slide that I frequently use for presentations on this area as a way of helping me stay on focus here. I'm going to read you guys something. And just let me get to this real quick. I'm just on my computer. When we look at learning in the classroom and we look at the idea that can the child learn what everybody else is learning or do they need to learn, can they learn something different? The idea of inclusion is that the child is actively engaged in what's going on in the classroom, the activity. The content does not need to be the same because the child might not be able to do the content, but the actual activity would be the same. So the idea of accommodations versus modifications is getting a lot of attention, especially the far-reachingness of accommodations, understanding what those are. Most important for our high schoolers. When kids get into high school and the grades truly count and are truly important towards the competition of getting into college, we need to recognize what an accommodation is. And basically, in short, it means that the child can still learn the information and they can learn it and they can retain it, and therefore they have a way of demonstrating it, even though it might be something different than everybody else. And an accommodation means that as long as the child is learning the same or similar content knowledge, it doesn't matter how they learn it or how they demonstrate it, it is still considered an accommodation. And therefore the grade is exactly the same as their peers. There is no change in grading. So let me give you an example. If the teacher was doing in 10th grade, the students had to write an essay on the relationship of the Allies in World War II. So now, you know, we're in world history, in U.S. history, and we're looking at a pretty advanced concept, which is the relationship of the Allies in World War II. That's what they need to learn. The way of assessing the knowledge the teacher is using for the kids is to write an essay. Let's say Timothy has difficult time with writing, either physically or just getting his thoughts onto paper, a difficult time with writing. But he is a fantastic artist, and he could draw a picture which is so intricate, which has to be a pretty darn good picture, way better than anything I could draw. And Timothy could draw a picture which was detailed enough to demonstrate the relationship of the Allies in World War II and capture the same points that the teacher was looking for. So the content knowledge is relationship of the Allies in World War II. The assessment tool the teacher is using is an essay. But teacher number two could be doing a multiple choice test. Teacher number three could be allowing the children to role play it and skip. And for Timothy, he's allowed to draw it. And so therefore, as long as he demonstrated the same content knowledge, if he did it with 100% accuracy, he would get an A, and it would be the same A as everybody else. And I think that's an area in terms of curriculum that we're really growing, the idea of curriculum adaptations and accommodations and modifications.
All right. Good deal. We've got a couple of last questions here. And let's see, we have Carrie from Saginaw, Michigan. And seems like Michigan and Minnesota keep popping up here. My child has high-functioning autism. He is in a regular education class with supports. He has an IEP which says he will get one-on-one time with a social worker for 30 minutes in a week, but this is not being done, and this is an area he most needs help in. I asked for logs of where they have met, and they refuse to give them to me. What can I do?
Well, it sounds like it's just not happening, is what it sounds like.
Yeah.
So, the person said in the question, potentially the logs, they may, if they are meeting, if they're saying they're meeting, it sounds like they're saying they're not meeting, but let's just say, for example, they're saying they are meeting. They should be able to give you logs as far as time, date and time. Note logs, they might not give you because if it's social work, counseling, they might be claiming confidentiality, professional
right.
patient confidentiality. So that would not be abnormal or wrong at all for them to say we can't give you our notes or our written logs from that meeting. But they should be able to give you dates and times of and frequency and duration of how long they when they met and for how long they met for. If they are not meeting, then and it's in the IEP, then they are basically what we call out of compliance with the IEP. And that's an issue. Not, it's not an IEP issue in terms of a disagreement between the school and the parent because it's in the IEP. So you have, I talked about IDEA, and then I talked about civil rights earlier. IDEA, if you were to go to due process, that meant that you had a disagreement with the IEP or an impasse. That means that you want this, the school doesn't want to give you this, or the school wants you this, and you don't want to do that, and you go to impasse. You go to due process, meaning this is a disagreement. In this situation, it's in the IEP, and it's not being delivered. In California, and I'm assuming it would be the same in every state, we go to that would be considered a compliance error, meaning the district is not in compliance with the IEP. Again, in California, and I assume it's this way in most states, we have a compliance board as part of our educational Department of Education. So the California Department of Education, as a special education unit, has the compliance board, and you would file a compliance complaint, meaning that the district is out of compliance with the IEP. I'm assuming that in every state there is a similar type of process, because usually those type of departments fall under the mandates of IDEA.
Okay.
And so you'd file a compliance complaint, and they would come and find out what's going on and mandate the district to provide that service since it's in the IEP. And if they say that they can't provide it because they don't have a provider, which may be the case, under law they would be required to provide that service, if it's in the IEP, to provide that service outside of privately outside of the school.
Okay. All right. I have another question here, and we're kind of coming up on less than 13 minutes, actually, before the call is over. So if you have any last-minute questions, folks, you better get them in now. We won't have much time left here. But we have one question here from Kim from Long Beach, California, and her question is it reasonable to introduce our recommended aids into the general education environment, like an auditory trainer that may assist or disrupt the typically developing children?
Is it reasonable to request? The answer is always yes. It's always reasonable to request. It might not be reasonable to demand, but it might be reasonable to request.
Right.
And the reason I say that is because you might be thinking, oh, that might not work, and maybe the school will look at that, and there might be someone sitting at that table who's really creative and say, oh, here's how we can make it work. So I think the question is really good in the sense of recognizing with inclusion that we need to be concerned and aware of what we do and how it affects the environment, the other people in the environment. But if it's the kind of auditory trainer that I'm thinking about where it's kind of an FM system, many teachers love that because it actually it helps them to teach to all kids. So depending on, you know, I would say in general, you know, special education, the best special educators and the best special education programs are those where creativity is a huge part of it or brainstorming. It's so difficult to provide the best services for our kids and to know what they are and to figure out how to implement them. And so creativity is key to the success of that. So always, if you have an idea, put it on the table. And maybe there'll be somebody who picks it up and goes with it, or maybe you'll, through conversation, come up with other ideas on other things or similar types of what to get that same need met. So always a good idea to put something on the table.
Mm-hmm. Really good. I have one person here that wanted to ask if you have a website that they can refer to.
I do. it's a great question.
IECP.us, is that it?
Yeah, it's IECP.us.
Right.
They wanted like something like $10,000 for .com, and we said we'll go with .us, and that should be fine.
Yeah, I noticed that. I noticed that.
Yeah, that was one. I guess that's one of the new endings that they have. They have .us, and they had .something else
sure.
going on. I forget what they were,
right.
But we weren't willing to spend $10,000 just for the .com. I hope people will be okay with the .us. Now, I do need to warn people, it's under construction. It's been under construction for years. We an interesting little side note here is we are actually one of the largest agencies in California. And like I said, I consult nationally as well. So we're one of the largest agencies in the country as well. But we've never been focused on our business practices. We've always been focused on our kids. This never started as a business. It started as I was providing services to kids. As I said earlier, I did my introduction, and more people started to ask, you know, I never had business cards, never had a website. I present at conferences, and I don't have a vendor booth. We don't try and sell our services at all. We just fortunately have done a good job with kids, and people have liked the work we did, and they kept asking for more and more, so I've had to hire staff along the way. And eventually we said, well, let's just make a website just because we get so many phone calls asking about the service. At least it would be easy and save us time, but it's still not the best-looking website because our focus is not on the business. Our focus is on the service.
Of course, of course. And that's how it all starts. I mean, if you focus on providing the help that people need, you know, all those other things will follow business-wise. But I do want you to give out your phone number, at least of the your service center, so that people can call in if they – you know, want to perhaps use your services.
Absolutely. Our phone number is area code 805-985-4808. Again, it's 805-985-4808. Of course, that's also on our website, which I said earlier is IEVP.us. And, they can feel free to email or call. They can email directly from the website as well. Any requests for services as well as any questions they may have.
Sure. Well, let's see here. We're going to pick up some straggling questions here, given that we're pretty close. Let's see here. Let me pick one. Let's see here. Let's see here. I have one woman here who says, my son is developmentally delayed. How do I get around the age issue? He is 20 years old, fourth grade reading, second grade math level.
Well, how to get around the age issue, I'm not sure exactly what she's looking for.
Yeah, I'm not sure either.
I guess I would say at age 20, academically where he's at, you know, theoretically, might not make that much more progress beyond that academic area, and to make sure we're focusing on the skills to help them be an independent adult. We've got lots of folks we work with that have no academics, no language, and they're still able to live independently or with supportive living and supporting work arrangements and participate in that community activities. So that does not prevent the individual, and actually, you know, the academic level that she mentioned for her son isn't fourth grade reading. You know, your average newspaper is written at a fifth grade level, so fourth grade reading isn't that bad. And second grade math is what most of us do, which is basic addition and subtraction. So actually not too bad. The importance is to make sure we're focusing on the skills he needs to be independent. People might not be familiar with this, but there was a study done back in the early 2000s. It's called SCANS. It was a federal research, and it was the Secretary's Commission. It was Secretary of Labor, I believe. Secretary's Commission on Acquiring Necessary Skills. People also know of it as the School to Career Research. And basically what they were looking at was, what are the school to career? What are the skills that our employers are looking for out of their employees? And this was a huge study that was, again, commissioned by the Secretary of Labor. And they interviewed thousands of employers, of just typical employers. This was not a special education, special needs type of study at all, just typical environment, community, individuals. And they researched thousands and basically asked the question, what are the most important skills that you are looking for in your employees? And what became overwhelming when you look at the SCANS literature, what is the top thing that employers are looking for are the ability to work independently and the ability to get along with your coworkers. And they could find different people with different skill levels for different jobs that they need. But what's important is, given that individual skill level, can they work independently and can they get along with their coworkers? I talked earlier about the use of one-on-one aids in inclusive settings and the danger of that. I'm not used to doing this on the phone. I'm used to doing this in person. But if you look at a scale, let me, how come I'm not good at this kind of thing, but let me try my best. Basically, what's important is that the individual's independent level is commensurate or above their skill level. I work with so many educators and families that are pushing academics, and they raise this kid's skill level up to these, you know, good areas, but their independent mm-hmm. level is still down. So if you look at a scale, independence would be on the high end, and academics or skill would be on the high end, and independence would be on the low end of that scale. And what we know is for adults with autism and other disabilities, the number one variable which affects their opportunities in life is their ability, their level of independence. And so independence needs to be commensurate, if not higher, than skill level. So teach a new skill, and then teach that child to be independent with that skill. Then teach a new skill, and teach a child to be independent with that skill. Don't keep teaching the skills without getting that child commensurate in their independent level. The most, you know, we need to make sure if we are including our children in school and we're not preparing them for an inclusive life, we're doing a disservice. We're only providing a third or less of their life in an inclusive environment. We need to make sure that we're including kids in school and we're giving them the skills, the number one being independent, to be able to be included outside of school.
Okay. Someone has asked us actually to spell the website one more time very slowly. I guess they were unable to hear it. But I believe it was I as in island, E as in Edward, C as in Charlie, P as in Paul, and, of course, .us, or as in .us. So hopefully they'll get that this time.
Right.
Well, let's see. We're coming up on 4 minutes. A couple people have actually gone to your website, it turns out, and they say it's very nice. Let's see here.
They're very nice.
Yeah. Well, they look through just the, I guess they're looking for things that they're most interested in. So, but a couple people have been there and posted their comments on online here. Let's see here. Here we go. We have one question here. You touched on this a little bit, Suzanne from Andrews, Texas, and her question is: is my first grader has sensory issues and Asperger's. What suggestions do you have for a student who is distracted by all the stimuli within the classroom? He is capable of the work, but his senses are overstimulated, and it's difficult for him to focus and or stay on task. I guess this is different from the cafeteria. This is actually someone physically in class.
Yeah, and with sensory integration challenges, it sounds like, and again, the easiest thing I could say is to talk with the occupational therapist about mm-hmm. sensory strategies that they could use to help that child with those challenges. You know, the occupational therapist doesn't just work on fine motor skills. Occupational therapy also works on sensory integration, especially in the area of autism. And so mm-hmm. the most universal thing I could say is to talk with your occupational therapist and ask them to look at those sensory issues and what we call is a sensory diet, to help that child develop a sensory diet, which are basically strategies and techniques of getting those sensory needs met. And again, it depends on the individual child on what those might be. A lot of our kids sitting in classroom for long periods of time, doing their best to pay attention, becomes very difficult, and they need a lot more proprioceptive input, which is that deep pressure, deep joint types of pressure, just to get them back to where they could learn, to get their system back functioning in a productive way again. Again, sensory diet, there's a million strategies within that. I'll share with you again one of those universal things that we do for a lot of our kids in the classroom, in inclusive classrooms, is we have what we call a weighted backpack, and it's the messenger's backpack. And it's just a backpack with weighted books in them. And whenever somebody leaves the classroom to run an errand, so, you know, our kid doesn't stand out, so whenever a child leaves, again, a way of including everybody is they have to take the backpack with them. The note goes in the backpack, and the child then runs that errand. And the most common strategy we do probably is that kid who's starting to need a little bit of input, and we see them starting to get a little bit over the top. Instead of calling attention to the behavior, which they can't control, they're having a difficult time right then, we just redirect them by asking them to run an errand, and the teacher would say, you know, Johnny, can you take this note to the office for me? And the teacher just writes a little note, you know, hope you're having a great day, puts it in the backpack. Johnny puts this weighted backpack on, walks out of the room, walks to the office, gives the note to the office staff. He then comes back, and hopefully he's got some of his sensory needs met, and he's a better place to learn. But that's just one strategy out of literally the hundreds, and the, you know, to look for a sensory diet for the student would be the first thing to do.
Sure. Well, Rick, I want to thank you so very much for your time today. I really do. This subject is quite popular amongst the parents here. We fielded over 83 questions here during the time that we're on the phone. And I just want to say thank you so much for your inspiration, your time. We love what you're doing. And certainly one of these times we'd like to have you back to discuss even more issues with us. But for now, this is the end of the call. But for those of you that are still on the line, I wanted you to do me one big favor here. I want you to tell me what you thought about the call. If you could, tell me what you most liked about the call, or what strategies you felt were going to be useful to you to make a difference in your child's life. Tell me what those are. And then tell me if you would be willing to recommend this to someone else to call in and get this information. As you know, this is a totally free call, and we'd love to hear what you have to say. We'd love to get your feedback, and just give me your testimonial. Now, this is the best way to do this. You can actually call a number right now, which is, you write this down, is 877-211-0212. That's 877-211-0212. And when you hear the voice on the phone start up, just press 1. And that'll get you directly to the line where you can just simply tell us what you think. We'd love to hear back from you. This helps us do a better job of the calls in the future, add more subjects, tell us what you like, what you want us to add to this next time, and we really appreciate your feedback. Once again, that number is 877-211-0212, and then just press 1. Hey, guys, thanks a lot for everything. Rick, thanks so much. We know you're busy, and we appreciate your time. This has been a wonderful call, and we've helped out a lot of parents today.
Great. Well, thank you for having me, and good luck to everybody.
Okay. All right, then. Thanks a lot, guys. Bye-bye.